I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee, Executive Editor at Information Security Media Group. Today I'm speaking with technology and privacy attorneys Ariana Abulafia and Andrew Crawford of the Center for Democracy and Technology. We're going to be talking about a research project the National Institutes of Health recently announced involving the collection of medical records from a number of federal and commercial databases to study autism spectrum disorders and some other work involving the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and various potential data privacy concerns. So initially, NIH said it planned to create an autism disease registry in an effort to research autism. But now, since the initial announcement, NIH appears to have scaled back those plans somewhat involving a registry and has said that it is actually a real-world data platform that will link existing data sets to support research into causes of autism and insights into improved treatment strategies. With that said, what were some of your initial data privacy concerns involving a registry, and what still concerns you based on what NIH has said so far? Ariana?
My biggest concern as a disability rights advocate and someone who focuses on data privacy was this idea that the federal government would be compiling health-related data, disability-related data from federal sources, but also from commercial sources to create a federal registry of people with autism without their consent. The disability community has, on many occasions, expressed their well-founded concerns that are based in long-standing concerns about the creation of registries of people with disabilities. This is something that the disability community, and in this case, particularly the community of folks with autism and neurodivergent people, that have expressed over and over and over again that this is something that concerns us. And so I think on one hand, there was a real question over, again, the lack of consent, the compiling of information from federal and commercial sources, both, and then the use for the creation of this registry, but also the question of, is it only going to be used for this purpose? Who is really going to have access to that data? How many third parties, how many additional researchers will be able to see it? And then, secondarily, what will that data and that registry, right, if it were to be created, which, as you mentioned, is now apparently no longer the case, but I think there still begs the question of what is this data that they are hoping to compile going to eventually be used for? And I think that is a question still, even with the news of the stepping back or the scaling back, that we don't necessarily have an answer for. I don't feel that there is a ton of information about what this research project will look like or what the data will eventually be used for. Andy, do you want to jump in?
Sure, I'll just add a few points. And I fully associate with a lot of the concerns that Ariana already highlighted. One more that I'll highlight that sometimes doesn't get as much attention, but I think is critically important, is the element of trust between patients and their providers, and patients and consumers, and the devices, apps, and websites we use every day. The announcement from last week raised a host of questions that Ariana did a great job of highlighting. That didn't have a ton of answers around how consent will be obtained, if at all, who will have access to this data once it's compiled and collected by the government, how will it be used by the government. And all those uncertainties raise a lot of questions for folks who are the subject of this data. It's one thing when you exchange information with your doctor, for treatment. You do that because your doctor needs the information to develop a treatment plan for a diagnosis. And similarly, in the kind of consumer space, when you interact with an Internet of Things device, like a fitness watch, an IoT device, when you interact with an app that you've downloaded on your phone, when you interact with a website, you as the consumer have a level of comfort, potentially, because you've decided to use that app or that device, and the information you're sharing is used for a purpose that you're comfortable with, that you know about. You're sharing the information again with your doctor for better treatment diagnostic. You're sharing the information with your fitness tracker so that you can get the results of your latest workout. When that data is then used for a secondary purpose that you as the patient slash consumer don't know about, there can be a lot of harms associated with that secondary use that Ariana again did a good job of highlighting. And when you learn about those secondary uses, you as the patient and consumer might be more hesitant than you were previously to trust your personal information, your health information, your biometrics with your doctor, with your health provider, with your IoT device, with the app on your phone. And that has several harms in and of itself, that loss of trust. Your medical diagnostics might suffer as a result of your hesitancy to share information with your doctor because you're uncomfortable with how that information might ultimately be used. And the same holds true in a consumer context. You might withhold information or just simply not use products, websites, apps, or services because you don't trust the end data use. If the government is going to be compiling registries with unknown, lots of questions about how it's going to be used, how it's going to be, who has access to it, how it's going to ultimately be rolled out. That's a lot of unanswered questions that can lead to a lot of uncertainty and a lack of trust.
So with that said, you mentioned about, secondary uses. Also, the project is said to aim at studying autism, autism research. But couldn't other sensitive health and personal information about people be swept up into this collection and to be used for other purposes beyond autism if there aren't some guardrails set up?
Sure, I think the answer is absolutely because there was no clarity given around the announcement, and frankly, there's not a lot of clarity given around the kind of stepping back from the registry creation. So I think there's very real questions around what HHS will be collecting moving forward, how it will be used, and what the data will be. I think there's a host of both commercially available data sets and also more HIPAA covered data sets, the data that is exchanged between you and a health provider that may very well be implicated in such an announcement, in such a project. But we just have no clarity right now. And it's very, that uncertainty leads to a lot of questions that we just don't have answers to. So it's a very real possibility that not just data around disability, but more general health data, biometrics, even, more sensitive types of data like location information could be swept up. But we don't have any clarity right now, and that uncertainty leads to a lot of open-ended questions.
I agree. I think that there is absolutely a concern that data that is not just related to what HHS and NIH say they are studying, in this case, one particular thing, autism, but when they're saying that they are hoping to compile data from agencies, from insurance companies, from wearable technologies, and as Andy referred to them as Internet of Things devices. I absolutely think that there is a potential that they will get much more data that is broader in scope than data that may be necessary or even, quite frankly, helpful for studying the thing that they say they want to study. And I think that is one of the concerns here in this instance, but also with some of this administration's track record thus far on compiling data. And it then being used for some sort of secondary purpose. And I'll just reiterate, I think that, again, as a disability advocate, I welcome the news that they are stepping back from the creation of a registry, but I still think there are many questions as to what the data collection process here is going to look like, how affected populations, in this case, neurodivergent people, people with autism, people with disabilities, will be considered and ideally, in my ideal world, centered in this research design and the data collection design on those sorts of things. I don't have assurances that those things are going to happen, even if I do have, to a certain extent, an assurance that at least they have stepped back on the idea of creating this registry. But I still think there are questions as to how the data is collected, what the data is eventually going to be used for, and whether the disability community, the community of folks with autism and neurodivergent people are being properly considered. And I don't feel I have those sorts of assurances at this point in time.
Should individuals be given an option to give their consent, for instance, to participate in something like this and to share their records for a government project such as this? NIH, I guess it sounds like, you know, they might be taking some data that's already in various, you know, health-related agency data sets, but, you know, to go out to the private sector and then, you know, they can't just like demand that people hand over information about patients, for instance, unless those individuals gave consent to be part of a research project, no?
I think at minimum, individuals should be given the option to opt in, give consent for this type of data use. However, I will say the opt-in, the notice and consent privacy regime we currently operate here, especially at the federal level in the United States, is not consumer friendly. It's outdated, and frankly, we've been continually advocating here at CDT, the Center for Democracy and Technology, to move beyond this outdated notice and consent privacy regime, especially around sensitive data sets. It places a huge burden on each one of us to review the policies of all the apps, all the websites, all the devices we interact with every day to make sure we're comfortable with those terms. It is unrealistic to expect each consumer to do that on a regular basis and fully comprehend everything that's put before them in those policies and terms. And moreover, the amount of time and effort it would take to do that, given the ubiquity of connected services and devices we interact with every day, is just not a reasonable and workable model. We've proven that out, and it's not going to work moving forward. So, at minimum, a consent to opt into this type of collection and use of data. But really, we need to move beyond just a notice and consent regime to something that embraces much stronger data collection limitations and purpose and use limitations so that a consumer, a patient knows when they turn their data over, it's going to be used for the product, the service, the treatment, the diagnostic that they want and won't be repurposed for secondary uses. Like advertising, like profiling, like selling to data brokers, like selling to insurers. Those types of secondary uses are harmful, are unwanted, are frequently unknown to consumers, and that's why we need a stronger privacy regime around that data. Folks might think that, oh, but we have a health privacy law in the US. It's HIPAA, it's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. What folks don't always appreciate is that the way that the privacy protections, especially the sharing limitations of HIPAA, apply, is they only apply when the data, when your health data is held by someone in the medical space. I'm being general here, but generally speaking, when your doctor has your data, when your health insurer has your data, when anyone kind of in the provision of healthcare has your data, yes, HIPAA is going to apply and they're going to have, those entities aren't going to be able to just share your data for unhealth-related purposes. But IoT devices, fitness trackers, health and wellness apps on your phone, health and wellness websites are frequently not associated with your doctor. They're not associated with your insurer. And instead, the privacy regime that attaches to those is basically going to be the terms and services that those companies themselves lay out. And like I said earlier, it's incumbent that makes it incumbent on each and individual person to read those terms and make sure they're comfortable, or just, you know, it's basically a take it or leave it proposition. You either accept the terms or you don't use the product or service. And again, that's a result of this outdated notice and consent regime that we really need to move beyond.
Building upon that, also, presumably, this autism research will pertain to children, pediatric patients, perhaps minors. What are your concerns related to that? Because, you know, even if a parent gave consent to whomever, you know, to get their records for their child, you know, to this research project, you know, once that individual, the minor, becomes an adult, you know, that information's already left. You know, there's already a collection somewhere that this person might have been diagnosed with autism, and maybe, you know, there's other concerns for that person when they become an adult. What are some of the concerns when you look at this from that perspective?
So, yeah, I'm not an expert on all things kind of child and children's privacy, but I do think you raise valid concerns when it comes to agency of children as they move forward and become adults, whose data may have been shared when they were kids in a way that they may or may not be comfortable with now, as they age and become adults. So I think there's real, I think you raise a really good concern, a really good flag. I just don't have a ton of additional expertise when it comes to like kids' privacy. So I don't really have much else to say on that point.
I would agree on that. I'm not an expert on youth privacy in general. What this sort of this occurrence, right, of like the federal government making this announcement and then kind of walking it back, I do think it is possible that this may have even parents sort of thinking a little bit deeper about whether they want to share that data. And I will say that I don't think that is necessarily a bad thing, right? For parents to at least consider quite deeply whether they want to share this specific data about their children who may have disabilities or autism or neurodivergence or something like that, and who they want to share it with, and to consider that quite strongly. But the other thing that I'll say just as a point is that I'm not sure that this study was meant to encompass the data of minors. And that's partially because, as Andy mentioned earlier, and I know I've honed in on this topic as well, there wasn't a ton of information about this in the beginning when it was first introduced, and then secondarily when it was kind of walked back or stepped back. So I'm not sure that this was meant to encompass the data of minors, but if it was, and if future sort of projects do ask parents to opt into that sort of thing, I do think it's worth at least considering some of the topics that we've brought up in this conversation, which is that we may not necessarily know who's going to wind up seeing that information, how long it will be retained, and realistically, what it is eventually going to be used for.
And how about, we talked a little bit about consent. What about de-identification of the data? Would that help if, this data is collected, but they don't have a way to kind of trace back, who it belongs to? And is that even a sort of a reasonable expectation?
I think that sure, de-identified, anonymized data sets facially present fewer privacy concerns. However, there are ample examples that exist where supposed anonymized, de-identified data sets, because of the nature of the data themselves, can easily be re-identified with little to no extra kind of legwork or elbow grease. And as a result of that, the privacy, the potential privacy protections that are associated with the anonymization, the de-identification kind of evaporate. So I think you have to be really careful with how you structure any sort of de-identification such that it is actually going to be very difficult, if near impossible, hopefully, to re-identify that data. But we are encountering technologies now that are very powerful, that can crunch lots of data very quickly, very efficiently, and very accurately, and can do a lot of the kind of re-identification that might not have even been possible 5, 10 years ago.
The other thing I'll add, and I've spoken about this before, I want to echo what Andy said, which is that yes, in theory, de-identification or anonymization is a good principle of data privacy, right? There are all of these secondary questions as to how effective it is, as Andy mentioned. But something I'll say just as a threshold matter is when the initial proposal was, okay, we're going to collect this data and we're going to use it for purposes of creating a registry, I don't really see how data can be properly de-identified or anonymized if the purpose of the data collection is to create a registry, which is essentially like a list. And that list, at least insofar as I conceptualize it, would have to include some sort of identifier. And again, since NIH and HHS seem to have walked this plan back, I do believe that they may be able to do more on, best practice of data privacy, including things like anonymization and de-identification, if the goal is to do research, which something I want to make clear is I'm not against, NIH doing health-related research, but we want to make sure that the data collection for that research is just done in a responsible way.
And finally, for each of you, I'll start with you, Arianna. Is there any other sort of top health data privacy security related issue that you're keeping an eye on right now as it pertains to the federal government or even state governments for that matter?
Sure. I mean, I think again, like I always say I'm a disability person first and a tech advocacy person second. And so for me, I think just as we look at, whatever occurs in this administration federally or in state administrations with the collection or the compiling of really sensitive health and disability related information, for me, one of the top things is looking at whether affected populations, so people with disabilities, people with autism, neurodivergent people in this case, are being properly centered and properly considered. I think that as a sort of framing point, that is my biggest concern, especially as we move towards what appears to be a trend, at least federally, of the compiling of data that was originally provided for one purpose being used for some other secondary purpose.
So two things I'd add, and I'll follow up on Ariana's last point first. So we've seen a recent example of data that was collected for one purpose now potentially being repurposed, and that's the bankruptcy announcement of 23andMe, the DNA analysis company. We've all seen reporting. They've entered bankruptcy, and one of the most valuable assets that the company is potentially going to sell in a bankruptcy proceeding is the biometric and genetic information of their customers. We've seen reporting across the board that shows that customers are not comfortable with that prospect, and there's been an uptick in individuals trying to learn how to delete their data and ensure that their privacy is preserved. Because, as I mentioned earlier, consumers might have been totally comfortable with 23andMe having their data and providing the service that those customers wanted, genealogical history, ancestry history, potential predispositions for health conditions. But when that data is then basically in the open market for the highest bidder, folks are very uncomfortable with that. This is a very sensitive data set. It's not like a credit card number where if it gets lost, stolen, you get a new number that's totally different. Biometrics are They're yours. They don't change. They identify you every instance. So I just use that as an example of a recent story where consumer trust and consumer privacy concerns are at the fore. To the other part of the question, what other trends I'm keeping an eye on at the federal and the state level, I'll again return to a previous point that we continue to suffer from an outdated notice and consent privacy regime, especially around sensitive data like health and biometrics. Some states have taken efforts to update their state-level laws to better protect health information and biometric information. And we've had efforts at the federal level to pass both a comprehensive privacy bill and also more sector-specific bills that are more focused on health. We haven't seen that materialize at the federal level yet. And that's something that I continue to keep a close eye on and continue to advocate for, especially around sensitive data sets like health data, where we really need meaningful collection, use, and purpose limitations that just don't exist right now.
Well, thank you so much, Ariana and Andrew. I've been speaking to Ariana Abulafia and Andrew Crawford of CDT. I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee of Information Security Media Group. Thanks for joining us.